I hope I have this down right, thanks to my technical advisor. Bienvenidos a todos. Welcome to everybody. On behalf of the Alliance for Health Reform, our congressional leadership, Senators Rockefeller and Collins, and the rest of our board of directors, my name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance, and we're very pleased to have you join us at this forum on concerns about the health of Hispanics in America, which we think is the sleeper issue in what many believe will be the most important health care debate in a generation. And how are we going to reform, if you will, the health care system in 2009 and beyond? The partner that we have in our program is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, America's largest philanthropy dealing with and working to improve health and health care in America. You're going to be hearing from Deborah Perez in a moment. We're also pleased to have Adam Coyne with us from the foundation. In a couple of weeks, the U.S. Census Bureau is going to release its findings on the number of uninsured Americans in 2007. And unless there is some miraculous improvement from previous years, you're going to find that Hispanics will have been uninsured at a rate three-quarters again higher than the rates for African Americans and three times as high as the rate for non-Hispanic whites. You couple that with one other figure from something that's in your packets. It's the U.S. population projections that the Pew Research Center has done. And that shows in one of the graphs that by 2050, the share of the population that will be Hispanic compared to what it was in 2005 is going to double to 29%. And the number of Hispanics over that period is actually going to triple in the United States. Now, you put those facts and trends together, and I think they raise serious questions about the impact of Hispanics on the healthcare system and vice versa. As the healthcare reform debate intensifies over these next few months, any thoughtful reform that gets proposed is going to have to take into account the Hispanic factor, if you will, in a variety of ways. And rather than belabor that point, I think I'd like now to introduce my co-moderator for this discussion, Deborah Perez, who's a senior program officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and a nationally known expert on healthcare disparities in her own right. Deborah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Ed. I'm very delighted to be here, and thank you all for joining us. This is, in fact, one of the most important topics facing the nation today. Increase in the number of Latinos, the variation in diversity within the Latino population, and what we're going to do to prepare ourselves for the next wave. I just want to say a few words about a collaboration that we've been engaged in with the Pew Hispanic Center, and that this is the first time that we've been able to do a study that has such a vast number of Latinos and covers a number of the much of the diversity that we're talking about. And you'll hear from Susan's presentation in a little bit some of that diversity. But I think it's important to understand that whatever solution we come up with, and at the foundation, obviously, we're concerned with a number of issues related to chronic disease management, diabetes, obesity, and the uninsured, that we need to start thinking about tailoring those interventions to the specific subgroups within different populations. And that includes understanding the differences among Latinos with regard to language spoken at home, English versus Spanish, immigrants versus non-immigrants, arrival in the U.S. at a young age versus arriving here as an adult, and differences between Cubans versus Mexicans and Puerto Ricans. I think that what we need to accept, finally, is that there is no one-size-fits-all solution for all the problems that Latinos face in this country. So I'm going to turn now to introduce Susan, who's going to give you a brief update on what we found. And I just want to introduce her, and you have a full bio in your packet, but a couple of very important things is that she's the deputy director of the Pew Hispanic Center, whose mission is to improve the understanding of the U.S. Hispanic population. And the Pew Hispanic Center is a nonpartisan research organization supported by the Pew Charitable Trust and takes no advocacy or policy positions. And you'll hear just the facts from Susan, I think. On a personal note, Susan and I have been working together for the past few months. This report is a very significant report for us. It's the first time that we've entered into this type of collaboration. She has her PhD from Columbia in political science and specialized in Latin America. So, Susan.
Hi, thank you for having me here today. Today I'm going to briefly present some of the survey findings. Your packets should all have the presentation, so I won't belabor some of the data, and I'll let my co-panelists take over the discussion from there. So the survey explores Hispanics, their access to health care, where they get health care information, and some questions about their knowledge about an important chronic disease. Well, let's start off. Hispanics in the United States, there's about 45 million of them. Hispanic adults, roughly 30 million Hispanic adults. Well, it's a young population, and it's generally a healthy population. That said, they do have a higher prevalence of overweight and obesity, and they have a greater predisposition to diabetes than the non-Hispanic white population. Here's some data from the CDC that shows the age-adjusted prevalence and risk factors for Hispanics compared with whites and blacks. Whoops. So one of the first questions that we looked at in the study is, who has a place for medical care? Because when you're thinking about chronic disease, or when you're thinking about a population that is today healthy and young, but will be getting older and has a predisposition to a serious chronic disease, you want to think about how they get their medical care, where they get their medical care. So we asked a series of questions if people had a usual place where they could seek medical care or ask questions of a medical professional. And if they said yes, we asked them where that was, a doctor's office, a clinic, a hospital outpatient center, or an emergency room. They volunteered the kind of place. And some people said, no, they don't have any of those places. Well, what we did is we defined, in line with the existing research in healthcare, having a usual provider for healthcare being anyone that says, yes, they have a usual place to go for care other than the emergency room. So if they went to a clinic, if they went to a doctor's office, if they went to an outpatient center, all of those counted. So the first thing here is I want to talk about who is it that lacks a usual health care provider that they can go to when they're sick or to ask questions to. Overall, 27% of Hispanic adults say that they lack a usual health care provider. They don't have a place to go other than those that said that they have the emergency room. How many is that? Well, if there's roughly 30 million Hispanic adults, there's somewhere between 7 and 8 million Hispanic adults, a large city sized, who do not have a usual provider for their health care. Well, that's interesting, but who are these people? Because at Pew Hispanic Center, one of the things we want to do is look within the Hispanic population at the diversity within that population. So here's some data. Who lacks a usual provider? Men are more likely to lack a health care provider than women. Young people, more likely than older people. Those with less than a high school degree, more likely than those with more education. The uninsured, much more likely than the insured. But interestingly, 20% of the people who do not have a usual health care provider actually have health insurance. So if we do a quick calculation, if we say, okay, there's roughly 8 million Hispanics without a usual place for care, and there's roughly 20% of these people have insurance, we've got a significant number of people with insurance who don't have a place for care. We also paid great attention in the survey to the national origins, the ancestry of Hispanics, because we believe that it's important to know if there are differences between a recently arrived immigrant from Mexico and someone that's Puerto Rican ancestry living in the United States. Well, in fact, we do find differences based on national origin or ancestry. We see that Mexicans and Central Americans are much more likely to lack a usual health care provider than perhaps Puerto Ricans. As one would expect, those who are Spanish dominant are also more likely to lack a usual provider. And those who are foreign-born but not a legal permanent resident. We have four categories. We ask people if they're citizens, if they're native-born citizens, naturalized citizens. If they're not citizens, we ask them if they're legal permanent residents. The remainder are foreign-born, not legal permanent residents. We don't know that all of these people are undocumented immigrants, but we feel quite sure that the largest share of this group are undocumented immigrants, and they are much less likely to have a usual place for care, as are those who arrived in the United States within the past 5 years. Well, why should we care? Well, preventative care, I think I will venture an opinion, even though I'm from Pew Research Center, and say preventative care is probably a good thing. So we looked at who is getting certain kinds of preventative care or monitoring of their health, and we compared between those who have a usual health care provider and don't. And those who don't have a provider are much less likely to have had their blood pressure checked, much less likely to have their cholesterol checked, much less likely to have their blood sugar tested. And even among Hispanics who told us they have been diagnosed with diabetes, those who do not have a usual place for care are much less likely to have had a blood sugar test in the past 2 years. So why don't these people have a usual place for health care? One might imagine, it's because they don't necessarily have insurance or whatever. Well, that is true. But the largest number say that they don't have a place because they're seldom or never sick. And an additional number added to that say that they take care of themselves, they treat themselves. Well, as I mentioned, this is a young population that on many measures is healthier than the population as a whole. And so in fact, it may be that they don't get sick. However, as I mentioned, there is the prevalence of overweight and obesity in the community adjusted for age. So even though they're young, they're heavier than other people the same age. And we see also the financial reasons are important. Roughly 28% cite no health insurance and the cost of medical care. So where are Hispanics getting information? If they're not asking doctors, and most do get most of their medical information from doctors, roughly 70% are getting information from doctors. But the media, we can see, is playing a very important role. More Hispanics are getting information from the media than from doctors, although I do want to emphasize 71%, 7 in 10, are getting their information from doctors. So as we see, within the media, television is the most important. So the health information that Hispanics are getting from television is almost as many Hispanics are getting information just from television as are getting information from doctors and other medical professionals. Well, I can't comment on whether the information they're getting is good or bad. But what I can say is that those that do receive information from the media make changes in their behavior. 41% who get health information from the media say that it has affected their decisions about how to treat an illness or a medical condition. 57% say that it has led them to ask doctors new questions. and 64% say that the information they learned from the media has changed the way they think about diet and exercise. I think there I'll conclude. There's a lot more in the survey. There's a lot more in the packet I provided, but I want to leave the lots of space on the panel for the rest of them to discuss some of the what they believe are the implications and policies that come out of this survey. Thank you very much. The survey is available on websites of both the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Pew Hispanic Center. And just as a last note, Pew Hispanic Center, we are nonpartisan, non-advocacy, and take no policy positions on the issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Excuse me. Now that you have the Joe Friday version of this issue, just the facts, nothing but the facts, we're going to turn to some people who can help you put it in context. Before I introduce them, let me just handle a couple of housekeeping chores. In a few days, you're going to be able to get a transcript of this briefing on our website. The Alliance's website is allhealth.org. It'll also be available on kaisernetwork.org, along with digital versions of the material in your packets. And I want to call attention to one thing that is, well, a couple of things that are in your packets. One of them is a list of further resources that you didn't reprint, but you have links to. And if you go to the website, you won't have to type the 28-character URL. You can just click on it and get the material. The other thing that's in there that I want to make sure you see is what we call our Find an Expert service. We've assembled 400 or 500 of the country's top experts on different topics in healthcare that you as a reporter can access if you register with us, and there's a way to do that in your packets. You can sort by geography, you can sort by the subtopics of expertise you want to find, you can sort by the ability to do an interview in Spanish, and you'll be able to find a number of people who can fit your needs. If you have any questions, Bill Irwin, our communications director, is the person who can answer those questions. He's also the person who did all the heavy lifting in arranging today's briefing, so we want to try to be responsive to that. And as I say, we have, that is to say, Bill with some substantial help, have assembled, I think, a terrific panel to help you sort out and place in context the facts and the trends that Susan has delineated for you. As Deborah did, we're not going to give these folks the introductions that they deserve because there's information in the packets about their biographical background. But let me just sketch in the merest terms who you're going to be hearing from. First up is Bill Vega. Bill is a professor of medicine at UCLA Medical School, where he's done a ton of research on Latin adolescents and adults, work that's made him literally one of the world's most quoted social scientists. And he was also deeply involved in this Hispanic Center, Pew Hispanic Center survey. Next to me is Dr. Elena Rios, who's the president and CEO of the National Hispanic Medical Association, one of the most visible and forceful spokespersons in the country on Hispanic health issues. She was directly involved in the health reform efforts in the early 90s and has been thinking through these reform issues for the coming discussion as they affect Hispanics. My far left is Sumi Souza. She's a healthcare advisor to California Assembly Speaker Karen Bass, served in the same position for the previous speaker, Fabian Nunez, during the negotiations with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger that almost yielded a sweeping reform bill. And that bill had in it important provisions affecting Hispanics, and we want to hear from her about how those came about and what they were. So if we can get started with William Vega, let's give you some context for this issue's framing. Bill?
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'm actually going to bypass the slide presentation because of the few minutes that I have available. It would take me the entire time to explain the slides, and I think they're redundant with what's been presented and what's in your packets already. I think I just want to be very concise and cover what I consider to be cardinal points of what the report is implying or actually saying. I think the critical thing to remember, as we said at the opening of the entire program here today, is that the Latino population today is growing rapidly, and the composition is somewhat unique, because three-quarters of the Latino population of the current 45 million in the United States are composed of immigrants or children of immigrants. The impact of that is that you have a population that is going through a very intense process of assimilation and culture change, which includes learning how to use the healthcare system and its exposures to the healthcare system. Now, those healthcare exposures are obviously very unsystematic. They because of the high levels of uninsurance, especially in the immigrant group, where we tend to see the real differences compared to the U.S.-born Latinos, differences in use of having a usual care provider, differences in quality of care received, differences in complaints about languages not being compatible and having problems in that arena, differences in knowledge about chronic disease. All of these are differences that really tend to disproportionately affect the immigrants, and most especially those that have less time in the country. 5 years or less, for example, I think only half of them did not have a usual source of care. So you can see that obviously people are going through a transaction of learning in this society about everything, including the healthcare system. And I think it's critical that we take that into account as we confront the possibility of healthcare reform in the future, that the real issues of understanding of how to use the system effectively and also having equitable access is a problem that affects the entire U.S. population, but especially affects the U.S. Latino population, and we need to give these issues inclusion in the discussion about any healthcare reform, both at the national, regional, and of course, ultimately at the local levels. I think this study was very, very useful because we rarely have studies that give us a lot of information about those that we know least about. For example, differences in Latino nationality groups, such as Central Americans, which turn out to have a level of twice as high of not having the usual care providers compared to, say, Puerto Ricans, who are more likely to have public insurance, for example. So, you know, this is a population, especially these newer immigrants, that is low education, low health literacy, a population that speaks predominantly Spanish. Therefore, how do they enter the healthcare system and get regular care? How do they come into the scope of public health services and get regular screenings, for example? These are really difficult issues that we need to cross in very practical terms, it seems to me. The study really points out where the jagged edges are, where these deficits are occurring. Beyond that, I think it's very interesting also to note from the information provided here that people who have a usual source of care benefit on several levels. One of them is that, for one thing, they're more likely to get guideline-based care from a physician if they have a usual source of care. That's reflected in the data in this report. That is, they're more likely to have the usual signals checked of blood sugar, for example, blood pressure, et cetera, the things that we automatically assume a doctor is going to do for us when we go see him on a regular basis if we're adults. Now, that will occur much more frequently if you have a usual source of care. It will also be more likely that you're going to get favorable reports about the quality of care that was received when you visited a physician or other health care provider. So those two things go together and are very important, it seems to me, in the ongoing dialogue in health care reform in this country. Since I am free to offer insights and opinions, because I don't work for Pew, and I can say to you that from the standpoint of understanding, you know, the big issues in healthcare reform, you know, one of the outstanding issues in the United States today is the fact that more and more we're going towards specialty care at a very time when populations such as Latinos clearly require greater access to primary care. This is undeniable when we look at the facts that come forward from this report, that they need a primary care access regularly. They need people that they'll be able to count on and with flexible schedules to come in and present their health care problems. This is a population that's a, you know, heavily worker population that works many hours, has family members that have different levels of coverage with health insurance and many with no coverage at all. And, of course, you know, the likelihood of any particular person in many of these families being not covered by health insurance over the course of the year is high. so in the immigrant population. So, you know, the confusion about what they actually can access in terms of healthcare resources, and especially specialty care, because of the fact that many of them are safety net users. I mean, they're using the safety net providers in the United States, and thus, as a result of that, do not necessarily have access to any type of specialty care easily without paying out of pocket. And in point of fact, the Latino immigrant population does pay a high percentage of health care costs out of pocket. So it's not to say that they don't get care at all. They are getting care. Obviously, it's limited by the lack of health care coverage by insurance, but there is a lot of out-of-pocket payment for health care. Nevertheless, the big picture adds up to a definite conclusion that the usual source of care, which is, as far as I'm concerned the cornerstone, is extremely weak on the Latino immigrant side. And even among those who are U.S.-born, if you look at the residual group of those who do not have a usual source of care of the entire Latino population, almost 50% of that is among U.S.-born, English-speaking Latinos. So obviously, and these are high school graduates. These are not people with minimal education. They at least have a high school education. So even in the group that is reporting not having a usual source of care, the reality is that half of that group is composed of U.S.-born. However, disproportionately, the U.S.-born are more likely overall to have health insurance. They are disproportionately more likely to have a usual source of care. So it's these issues, it seems to me, of how we get an improved access to care for Latinos that we really have to think about in terms of the arrangements that we develop in any future healthcare system, because it will ultimately affect whether they get a high quality of care, whether they get a quality of care that they're satisfied with as individual consumers. And all of us are concerned with that because we all consume healthcare services. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bill. Now let's turn to Dr. Elena Rios.
Okay. Thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here. I wanted to focus on solutions and strategies. Let me just mention who National Hispanic Medical Association is. We were established in 1994 here in D.C. We're a nonprofit organization that represents over 36,000 Hispanic physicians in the country. Our mission is to improve the health of Hispanics and other underserved. We are led by a board of directors, and our chairman is Dr. Ciro Sumaya, dean of the Rural Public Health School at Texas A&M, former administrator for HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration. And we also have established a foundation that does research and other educational activities affiliated with NYU's Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. In terms of the American Latinos and healthcare, the largest ethnic group now and will be in the New America by 2050. I'm calling a New America that will be a nation where over 50% of the population will be bicultural. I don't believe the word minority is in order, but I don't know what we're going to call ourselves. And this includes African Americans, Native Americans, Asians, and Hispanics. For the Hispanics, we are the most uninsured of all the groups, over one-third of all Hispanics. Most problems with disparities in health care, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services disparities reports. And there is a very critical need for cultural language and educational services in our health care system. And the system lacks Hispanics everywhere, whether it's researchers, providers, and especially leaders and decision makers in all our public and private agencies that impact healthcare. In terms of the Pew survey, these are two takeaways. One, the 2009 healthcare reform debate needs information. Health communication channels need to be targeted to the community less than 30 years old, whether that's low literate information, bilingual information, bicultural information, but there's got to be a new media approach for health communication in this country. And I believe, knowing my nephews and nieces, it needs to go through the internet and cable. There's lots of bilingual cable TV now that everybody's looking at in the younger generations. And I would call this social marketing through media in terms of health communications. And the second takeaway is for 2009's usual health care provider, I think that needs to be defined as a health team with community linkages who can change behavior with low-educated communities. And I'm not saying medical team because I believe it's a health team. We need the nutritionists and the educators and the mid-level to be a part of the team, not just doctors and nurses. And this health team needs to, in order to have a health team like this, we need to recruit Latino healthcare workforce now at all levels. And why? Because it's the Latinos who come from our communities who best understand how to communicate and treat and appropriately our communities. And we need a national prevention curriculum that focuses on diabetes and obesity in all our medical education, nursing education programs. So in terms of the NHMA and some of our strategies and solutions, we partnered with the HHS's Office of Minority Health and did three summits this year to develop consensus recommendations to improve the health of Hispanic community targeted to federal programs over the next 5 years. Three regional summits with 300 participants were held in New York, Sacramento, California, and Austin, Texas. The recommendations were announced at our national conference this last spring to the health policy advisors of Obama, Clinton, and McCain. The stakeholder participants were from private and public sector. We were very careful to have nominations, to have a balanced approach. There were consensus and facilitators to give us the recommendations. These are everybody that was at the participants from pharma and insurance companies to government to K through 12 teachers, et cetera. Our three areas of focus were access to health care, prevention of diabetes and obesity, and increasing Hispanics in the health professions. I'm only going to give you the access recommendations. These were ranked by, and done by consensus. The number one issue, of course, was financing, and of course, with health care reform on the horizon, our group thinks that universal and affordable health insurance coverage is the most critical policy needed for our communities. But we need to expand eligibility, not just have health insurance, but expand eligibility for the public programs that now exist and target families, target the undocumented, target the legal documented, target the federal poverty level. Look at comprehensive benefits that not only include prevention, but mental health, dental health, and educational services. Target individual mandates, make it automatic for everybody, portable, quality, accountable. Second issue in financing was to create low-cost care delivery and with public-private partnerships. I think what's important about this is that you take what we have now in the safety net and expand it. So if we have community health centers everywhere in our communities, we need mobile clinics to reach the harder to reach. In terms of the healthcare system, our access recommendations were to enforce standards for culturally and linguistically appropriate services through JCO, which is the accreditation body for hospitals and nursing homes, and promote cultural competency provider training because we know that there aren't enough Hispanic doctors and nurses, et cetera. There needs to be incentives, performance payments, federal clearinghouses. There needs to be language services, not only interpreters, but pooling of resources and federal laws to have access to these services. And we need to support providers in underserved communities, including strengthening the DISH programs and National Health Service Corps programs. And then lastly, the healthcare system needs to invest in a diverse workforce, fully fund our health careers opportunity programs and centers of excellence, which have been decimated over the last 3 years, and have a medical home that is the primary care home. We think it should be community health centers for all, with an increase in referral systems to tertiary care, which they don't have, and a patient-centered care approach. And then the last point, which was brought up by this survey, was to have more access policy in the area of education and marketing and to start promoting awareness at K through 12 through a standard health education curriculum in the K through 12 and to use promotoras, community health workers from our own communities for community education, have national media campaigns, and lastly, we need reimbursements and incentives for patient education within the healthcare system. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks very much, Dr. Rios. We did not get the chance to run off hard copies of Dr. Rios' slides, did we?
We have them at the front table.
So we have them at the front table. You can pick up a copy on your way out. Or you can sneak out there. when you finish your sandwich. Now let's turn to Sumi Souza from the California Assembly Speaker Office.
Great. Well, thanks for letting me come here. It was a long trip out from California, and I'm flying right back after this. So I actually switched my slides around, too, so I cheated a little bit. So you probably want to look up here instead of at the slides on your in your packet. You know, I think kind of building upon what all the previous speakers had said, to take it in a little bit of a more micro level on a state, but definitely a big state like California, basically what's happening in the Latino population is just really intense in California. So it really what's going on there drives policy in California, and whether that be in education, whether it be regard to our health care. Basically, it is a very, very important and large and growing population in our state. Right now, 35% of the population in 3 more years, they're going to be the largest racial or ethnic group in the state, and in 2042, so we'll do it faster than the national level. 52% of California's population will be Latino. So why does that matter? Well, California has the most uninsured of all the states, and boy, 60% of them are Latino. So it's very, very important that healthcare reform recognize the demographics of this population. And the other kind of obvious thing is 1 in 3 Latinos in California is uninsured. So California last year took a little bit longer than last year, but like a lot of other states, embarked on a serious attempt at health care reform, and it's something in the area of comprehensive health care reform, not a small reform. And it was really trying to address the big problems that all the other states are experiencing. We just happen to experience a lot of them, and that be the unsustainable growth in the cost of health care, the huge number of uninsured that we have in the state, the dysfunctional individual market that we have, the need for a prevention agenda if we're going to do anything about containing costs over the long run, and then lastly, trying to change the delivery system as we have it, which is not particularly rational or smooth. We had a very short window of opportunity. There's a certain Republican governor in California, you might know of him. In 2006, he said, well, 2007 is going to be the year of health care reform, and for Democrats, that's like, you know, magic to us. It doesn't happen very often, and he was serious about it, and so you had an unprecedented effort on the part of both the leader in the Senate and my boss, the Speaker of the Assembly at that time, Fabian Nunez, to really drive a bar, you know, some kind of a deal towards getting comprehensive health care reform in California. And that being said, within the context of a year, Massachusetts took 3 years, lots of other states were taken more than 3 years, we basically had a little bit over a year. That was largely because we have a two-thirds vote requirement, meaning it's very difficult to raise any money without Republicans, and Republicans have all taken a pledge of no new taxes. We had 2008 elections coming up, which we knew would be a big turnout year, and that would be important for financing. And so that meant that we had to have a deal struck pretty much by the end of the year. Significant constraints. I'm only going to list the really, really, really big ones because we had a lot of them. As I said before, two-thirds vote requirement on taxes. We had ERISA. We also had some really significant political constraints. A children's health initiative had just been defeated a couple of months before. A previous kind of more modest attempt had been referenda'd and had failed. And so you had a very organized lobby of folks, of the business community who were opposed to something that was what they viewed as burdensome on employers. Two-thirds vote requirement meant the governor had no Republican votes. And then the politics of immigration, which are very difficult in California like they are everywhere else. Okay, so let me go quickly over AB1X, which was, there were many versions of things that were in play, but AB1X was really the one thing that ended up being what we would consider the compromise bill. It established a system of near universal coverage. It wasn't total coverage. We'll talk a little bit more about that, particularly in terms of the context of Latinos. It was employer and individual responsibility, a version of pay or play with an individual mandate. established a purchasing pool for workers in firms that weren't offering coverage, and had a system of tax credits, which were largely subsidies for low-income workers. Many individual market reforms, including guaranteed issue and 8515 MLR, and then some very, very large public program expansions in the state's Medicaid program, which is called Medi-Cal, and in the state's SCHIP program, which is called Healthy Families in California, as well as something for an expansion program for childless adults. Not hitting the center here. There was a pretty significant rate increase via a quality improvement fee assessed on hospitals, public health and prevention programs, particularly targeted towards obesity, diabetes, and tobacco. A very hefty tobacco tax increase. It's about 87 cents right now. We were going to raise it $1.75 additionally. And some scope of practice changes to increase supply and availability of health care providers. Okay, so what does that have to do with the Latino population in California? You're all smart people here. You know it's pretty obvious. But I'm going to talk about it in terms of coverage, affordability, access, the prevention agenda, and then some workforce things. And I think it kind of marries a lot of what the discussion was earlier with regards to Pew and sort of how we approached it, although we were much less scientific than the Pew folks. as we talked about, one in three Latinos uninsured, we knew we wanted to do something about coverage. And the uninsured in California are largely low-income workers. 84% of the uninsured are workers and their family members. But Latinos work in firms that have one of the lowest offer rate, the lowest offer rates amongst all firms in California, which is about 70%. For the white population, they have an offer rate of about 90%, so you see the significant disparity. They also have one of the lowest take-up rates in California of 80% for those who are offered. So the structure of the pay-or-play component was very important for Latinos because many of them, while they're working, they work in firms that don't offer and don't spend. So the minimum spending requirement that was was proposed in 1X was important because it offered something for them and a place for them to go. There was a pool where they and their families could get comprehensive coverage at a fairly low cost. In addition, notwithstanding that population is working, there was a very large public program expansion. The important thing about that in terms of the context with Latinos was that we increased the eligibility limits for kids, but we also had no documentation requirements with regards to Medi-Cal and Healthy Families. That was very important because, as you know, a number of children, it's like basically close to 20% of the uninsured children in California are undocumented. There was also a coverage program, importantly, for the remaining uninsured adults, which is, as we all know, it's the undocumented. And that was via the state's nonprofit community clinics, which is essentially where they tend to go, would have created a medical home, kind of given them a card, all of those good things. Basically, let me zoom through the slides here because I'm already out of time. Basically, what we have – oh, great, thanks. What you have is you have about a quarter of the population in California is undocumented, so it's important that you have some type of a coverage program or a place for them to go because they're not going to be able to go into the purchasing pool and they're not going to be able to get into the public programs except for their kids. So the coverage program was very important. We used John Gruber in terms of our estimates, and basically he had kind of said in terms of the estimates about 71% of the uninsured would have been covered. Okay, let me go quickly over affordability provisions. I think the key thing is it's a low-income population. There were significant subsidies that were proposed in the bill that would have allowed folks who are working to be able to afford coverage through the purchasing pool or through a very low-cost means with regards to the public program expansion. Essentially, those refundable, advanceable tax credits would have been available to people 250% to 400% of federal poverty, very large population of Latinos. In that population, essentially 61% of Latinos have incomes actually below 250, so they would have been eligible for the public program expansion. And then the remaining that were under 400% of federal poverty would have been eligible for the tax credits. talk a little bit about one of the key things and kind of different in California is that we have a lot of folks who are eligible for public programs but remain unenrolled, and 68% of those are Latinos. It's Latino children. We have a real problem with that. We need to do more outreach, but part of it is also the fact that the Medicaid program is very difficult to get through. There were a number of enrollment simplifications with regards to the Medicaid program, and that would, we think, have made a pretty significant difference in terms of trying to cover the 800,000 kids in California that are uninsured. Let me talk just lastly on sort of the prevention issues that we dealt with. And I would just sort of say at the outset we didn't do enough because it was hard enough to try and deal with the financing and the coverage and the access issues that we were dealing with. But there were some very important pieces with regards to obesity, diabetes, and smoking cessation, community makeover grants, which would have gone directly to the local entities and would have been able to target folks, particularly with language and culture, in terms of the language and cultural different kind of barriers that we have right now, getting fresh foods into communities, trying to educate folks with regards to the obesity crisis. Nearly 7 out of 10 Latinos in California is overweight or obese. And with regards to diabetes, we have the same problem. While Latinos are, as folks talk about, largely a healthier population, although overweight and obesity is a real problem, in diabetes it's a growing problem. And I think the one thing that's important to note is kind of that last bullet, which is, well, 8% of Latinos in California are diabetic. 21% of Latinos aged 50 to 64 are diabetic. So that's it's a growing problem, particularly in our aging population. So let me stop there, and I'll take some. We'll go with the rest of the panel here and take questions.
I can't imagine anybody has any questions after all that presentation. But if you would identify yourself and direct the question to one or another of the panelists, if that is your want. And you had your first hand up.
And my second question is, I guess this is for Elena Rios. If, I think the stat here was that of those without a usual source of health care, 45% do have health insurance. So how would having universal health insurance for these people affect having a usual health care provider if almost half already do have health insurance and don't have a provider?
The importance, you noted the importance, we just can't have insurance. You have to have education to the population, that the population understands. And I'll give you an example. In our communities, babies are born fat, and that's healthy. And lots of mothers have gestational diabetes, and we have even more abundance of fatter babies. Not only that, in our communities, to have a child grow up through their adolescence and be skinny means they're not eating enough. You know, they must be sick. So for a provider not to understand that, the providers then will not be able to bring it up, or, you know, there would be tendency not to bring it up. So there's an importance in cultural education of our providers and understanding in our communities what sickness, what being sick means. So what is obesity? What is overweight? All those things have never really been discussed in the community outside of a doctor's office or a clinic.
Can I highlight in your first question, you asked why not having a usual provider is a problem if Hispanics are generally younger and healthier. There is this phenomenon called the Hispanic paradox, that immigrants come over healthier, they have lower socioeconomic status, lower income and education, yet have much better health outcomes. But what we know is that the longer they're in this country, the worse their health becomes. And I think that habits formed at an earlier age persist. So there's no, and I want to emphasize, and I might punt this over to Bill, we cannot overemphasize the importance of having coverage with regard to access to a usual source of care. It was twice as many people who had insurance twice as many Latinos without insurance said they had no usual source of care than those who had insurance. And so saying that while we recognize that it's a younger population, we need to prepare now for the long term when this population gets older and sicker. Bill, do you want to add to that?
Oh, yes, I think that it's part of the process of becoming an American over multiple generations that you begin to have the same health profile as Americans do, and that includes everything from substance abuse, mental health, as well as diabetes and obesity. So that obesity increases directly with the amount of time you've been in this country if you're an immigrant, and it's even higher if you're born in this country because you develop the same eating habits. Obviously, you learn the behaviors. And, in terms of the differences, I think it's very interesting that what Elena was just talking about, because when you go to third world countries, including Mexico, it's the wealthy that are obese, you see. And now in Mexico, because you're getting changes in the society itself, you're seeing more and more people in the middle class becoming obese. Still, in rural areas, you see it's rarely seen. Right? So the image in third world developing countries is obese is to be well off, that you're doing well. And to be thin is because you don't have enough to eat. I mean, it's actually scarcity. So clearly when people come to this society, the opportunity to have whatever you want to eat and to have it in great quantities, for example, especially fast food and processed food, et cetera, becomes available, you know, and that becomes a direct risk factor then. And I think the issue of preventive care is very important, too, that obviously all of us would think it would be pretty odd not to go to the doctor for years and not have just the usual checkups on blood pressure and blood sugar and heart and all the rest of this that goes along with just being taken care of. And it's not expensive, but it's certainly an early signal that there's trouble ahead. And, you know, things like diabetes take a long time to develop. I mean, we have to be very careful about this because if we can catch it early, we can perhaps prevent it as opposed to allowing it to develop. And most diabetes type 2 really onsets in the 50s. So, you know, if you wait that long, it's too late. They have diabetes, and then you have a big burden for the family, for the person, for the society, and you have a big cost burden.
My question is for the panel generally. That is, what if healthcare reform doesn't come? What if 2009 comes and there's no meaningful reform? What things would you have? You've set out a really excellent set of things that are needed to improve the health of the community. What will you do if the reform you're planning on or hoping for doesn't come?
I'll start by saying we haven't had major reform in 40 years, and that hasn't stopped our progress in terms of providing continuous, as best we can, access. And more importantly, the quality of the access to care. I don't, you know, want to overlook the fact that even with insurance, the quality of care is less than desirable, and this disparities exist. I think there are other ways to address the problem of health access and health care, though coverage is extremely important. We will continue at the foundation and other advocates for access to health and health care, quality health and health care, to work in this area, whether there's reform or not.
And maybe I would ask Sumi to respond to that, too. What are you going to do now that there wasn't reform?
Oh, well, let me answer in the very short term. The governor has come up with his health care light version, which is pieces that don't cost very much that he's trying to move forward. But I think, you know, the real answer is, look, healthcare reform is incredibly hard to do. I mean, in California, we failed. We had a very short amount of time. We got pretty close. But what it means is that the problems that we all identify with the system don't go away. Healthcare costs too much. Everybody feels it. Even the middle class feels it. And the rate of growth is unsustainable. We will continue to pay more for, you know, health outcomes that are worse than the rest of the world. The worst of the industrial world. So it just seems to me like, yeah, is it odds on favorite that it happens? No, it's really, really, really hard, and I think it's going to be a tough challenge. But the problems only get worse, and that makes the need for reform even greater.
Can I just add that there are things that we can do now? We know, for example, that racial and ethnic disparities exist in the quality of care. And so activating consumers, doing more with public reporting of the quality so that consumers can be informed and make decisions based on quality, and performance improvement measures. Those things help improve the quality of the care that's delivered. And at the foundation, we are embarked upon a nationwide 14-site regional quality strategy called Aligning Forces for Quality that does precisely that. It brings together the community, including the insurance companies, the business sector, the health provider sector, and consumers themselves to advocate for higher quality care.
Yeah, I just, coming from the federal level, looking at policies across the board right now, health disparities, I think, needs to have a more primary care approach. And the health disparities legislation that the Tri-Caucus in this Congress has introduced over the last 8 years, 6 years, 8 years, as well as Senator Kennedy and Senator Frist and now Senator Cochran on the Senate side, those are all very targeted bills that are very important. Unfortunately, they haven't passed, and I think perhaps we need to take a look at the pieces of those legislations to be able to incorporate them in a way that allows it to pass. But I do think that the health disparities legislation mirrors a lot of the solutions that we've talked about, and they've already been introduced, and there's lots of support from Republican and Democrat. I just think in the era of budget problems right now, domestic budget issues, we have to look at a more feasible approach to passing the congressional legislation.
Now, I would just say that it's clear that we have a real problem emerging in the adequacy of the healthcare professional resource pool, the human resource pool. We need people in all areas of allied health as well as physicians and nurses. As a result of that, it seems to me a very opportune time to increase the opportunities here for the pipeline to produce more Latinos who can come into those areas who can speak Spanish and who can supply more culturally appropriate services to this population. This issue of language ability being available, the capacity being available in clinics and healthcare providers is a critical one because all kinds of mistakes can occur in those situations, and we know that it affects satisfaction with care and the likelihood that people will go back to a particular provider. And as a result of that, it's very important to have availability of translators that are appropriately trained and people who are actually operating the providers and offering processes of care from secretaries all the way through to surgeons that speak Spanish and can communicate with their patients. This is a very big challenge because it goes to the core of the educational system itself and our ability to produce adequate numbers. But it's certainly one that we need to undertake in a multi-level way right now.
Yeah, hi, Andrew Gumbel. I'm leading the UC University of California Journalism Program here. I had a couple of questions. One, when you talked about Latinos getting a lot of health information from the media, I don't know if you looked into what kind of media. Is this advertisements on TV for diet pills, or is it shows where qualified doctors are talking with lesser or greater reliability? That's question number one. And question number two, if there is a big problem with Latinos disproportionately not having primary health providers, how can you make the case, or how can you project out, what impact this might have on long-term health costs in terms of, if you let things slip at the primary level, what kind of implications that has for burdening the system further down the line, especially with a large number of people suffering from diabetes and obesity?
In terms of the question about sources of health care, health information from the media, the question wording was very generic. How much information did you get about health and health care over the past year from, and then we asked about the source, doctor or other medical professional, family or friends, the radio, the internet, television. So we don't delve into it and know if it's from news programs or health programs or commercials. We don't evaluate the quality of the information either.
Can I just add something on that? Just the one thing that was really interesting to me during the whole healthcare reform debate in California was how closely it was followed, not just by the general media, but by the Latino and Spanish-speaking press, essentially. We had probably the greatest participation amongst the Spanish-speaking press. There was a full-time reporter covering it, both in print and on TV. and on radio. It was amazing, and it's because, and when you look, you know, look at some of those numbers of how many people in California are uninsured that are Latino, it's no wonder. And it was, so I included a few in the packet of just some of the articles that had come out, I think just a couple. But I think, you know, it would be interesting for some of your students to look back and do just do a search of, you know, Reforma de Salud in California, and you'll be surprised at how many articles actually pop up from La Opinión and Telemundo.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing, which is in relationship to who's using those sources, it tends to be the immigrants and the Spanish-speaking. So they're using Spanish-speaking media, they're using Spanish-speaking television, Spanish-speaking radio for that information. And I just want to harken back to the opening presentation, because it noted that the report clearly shows that they actually get information that they claim to be acting on. Now, we didn't observe how much they acted on this information, but they claim to be more likely to go to physicians to get clarifying information about health issues. They claim to be thinking more about how to change diet and exercise. Whether they change that behavior, we don't know. But at least it's prompting. It's prompting them to look into these issues. And given the alternative sources available to them, which are negligible from the healthcare public health community, especially in Spanish, I think it shows how important it is that the media is playing some important role in this area. And I think Spanish-speaking media has given more and more attention to obesity and diabetes.
I just saw the question that you asked about the cost long-term. Everyone's heard the phrase, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. There are people looking at the actual cost of the lack of primary care. I don't have those figures in front of me, but I can direct you to, for example, the Trust for America's Health, which looks at the low amount of resources invested in public health. Only about 1% of all NIH funding goes to public health, and their estimation is somewhere in the $30 million mark of underfunding in the public health agency, where a lot of these this population, the vulnerable, the undocumented, and the improper population rely on public health system to get the care they need.
Questions? Yes.
Want to use the microphone, Laura? Mm-hmm.
When in California, when you're looking at the costs for this, what are the overall health care costs sort of for the uninsured? And then, because I would assume because they're uninsured, they're delaying going into get treatment until it's sort of at a more drastic stage. And then similarly, how much of the health care costs are also for the undocumented, who also would be fearful probably of going into the system and probably also delay any health care seeking?
Well, it's a loaded question. let me answer it in this way. The cost of the proposal as it was outlined, which was which would have covered a lot of people, was roughly in the $15 to $16 billion categories for the in terms of a full year implementation. Clearly, we could not get the votes for that, and that was going to have to be on a ballot initiative. In terms of, you know, trying to pencil in and pencil out what the cost of prevention is versus the cost of coverage and versus the cost of access, I mean, we didn't do that. And the reason why is because, you know, I think that probably would have been a useful exercise to have afterwards. You know, the reality is when we're working in within a budget constraint and we're working within a, you know, current year and the next year's budget, and we generally had to look at, when you're talking about prevention, you know, those costs over time, you know, you'll probably see some decline in terms of cost, and I think you can look at some of the research there. But in terms of overall budgeting, you're going to have to budget for the upfront costs and prevention costs upfront, and we just kind of swallowed it and did it. And that's the tough thing, and that's why prevention and public health and all of these areas, of which, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, they often get short shrift compared to coverage, because coverage is the first thing that you need to do. It's not the only thing that you need to do, but it's the one of the first things you need to do, and it's the most expensive thing to do. And so everything else tends to get kind of crowded out. So the amount that we were spending on public health and prevention, you know, was probably much smaller compared to what the overall cost of coverage is. Although, you know, I think the idea that we were going to have a medical home for people who would not not have number one, we were going to provide some, you know, access to preventative care, obviously, for people who don't have any right now. And then secondly, and try and rationalize it so they were going to primary care as opposed to acute care. And then lastly, to provide some type of a coverage product, which we did, for people who would have been kind of the people who are left behind, the undocumented people who just simply won't sign up for Medicaid. So in terms of what it would have cost in terms of the undocumented, I mean, I'm not going to go there because we didn't look at those dollars, and they tended to get bogged down in the politics of it.
Let me offer the secondhand observations of a poor country lawyer in the midst of a bunch of professionals on this. But the generally accepted health policy estimate is that someone who's uninsured incurs expenses of about 60 cents on the dollar compared to somebody with insurance. So the idea that you can save money by putting more people in may be true in some long term, but you can't get the Congressional Budget Office to score it. And most of the analysts would tell you that if you give people coverage, it's going to cost more than not having coverage. That's why 18,000 people, the Institute of Medicine says, die every year because they don't have insurance and they don't get the services they need. Yes.
There's one other way to look at prevention and costs of care, and that is to change the paradigm that it is a community approach that we really need, not just a healthcare system overhaul. And the community approach would mean that the federal agencies that impact healthcare, and you might not realize that it's not just the Department of Health and Human Services, but it's the Veterans Administration, it's the Department of Defense, it is the Department of Housing, because we have to have safer housing and cleaner housing and no lead, et cetera. The Department of Commerce, because of our roads and the traffic and all the air pollution, the Department of Transportation, Department of Commerce, the Department of Labor, because labor sets the health care benefits to the workers of the country, to Department of Education, because of our educational programs within K-12 and colleges, and to really get your hands around health prevention. It's not health care reform. It's health care reform plus. And I think the term that's being used is transformation, that we have to transform the way we think in terms of health. And it's not about disease, which has been the approach of people talking about the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services programs are directed to diseases, NIH, you know, et cetera. But if you look at a health approach and how to have healthy communities, we need to engage all of our different federal agencies, and the money's there. It's just redirecting and transforming the way our leadership can understand how to redirect it.
I would just make a very quick point, which is most studies I've seen indicate that insured Latinos actually have a much lower cost to the insurance companies than do people of other ethnic backgrounds. That is, their per capita cost in terms of services utilized is considerably lower than it is for other populations, especially among the immigrant groups. So, you know, it's possible actually to cover this population at a per capita cost that's considerably lower and still be able to make a reasonable profit from it for these insurance companies. And so it's not a bad investment to cover this population if we can find a financial platform, you know, to finance it.
Oh, yes. Go right ahead.
Hi, Doug Trapp, American Medical News. I got a question and a follow-up, actually. Just wondering, you've touched on this a little bit. The panel has touched on this just a little bit. But how important are programs like Medicaid and SCHIP to getting coverage for, you know, Latinos, Hispanics of any type, documents or otherwise? Or is it more complicated than that?
Well, it is a complex issue. I'll touch a little bit on that. But it is SCHIP programs and state programs to provide coverage are extremely important, because one of the things that we know about Latinos in this country is that there are many, many eligible children who are not currently enrolled in SCHIP programs. There's a lot of reasons for that. Some of them might be they have undocumented parents or mixed parents. One is documented, one is not. And there's a kind of a fear to enroll their children. There's a ban in this country if you immigrate and you're applying for citizenship. You have to wait 5 years before receiving public benefit. And though that does not apply to the U.S. citizen child, parents think it does apply. And so SCHIP programs, state programs to provide health insurance to children, expanding that coverage to include low-income families, and raising the cap, those are important interventions.
You say you had a
totally critical. Yes. Couldn't do, I mean, for a state like California, can't do it without it. I mean, absolutely impossible. And it's for the same reasons that Deborah was talking about, but clearly it's just states cannot do it alone, and this is a low-income working population. And so it's trying to make some necessary adjustments with regards to eligibility and enrollment in order to get folks actually on, you know, these programs. 53% of Latinos in California 53% of the population of our entire Medi-Cal population, which is roughly 6.5 million, is Latino.
Simi, can I just ask you to follow up? I noticed that one of the features of your reform plan was a significant boost in reimbursement rates.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Bill. Twofold value. Number one, California is a terrible partner. We're probably the worst partner amongst all the states in terms of the Medicaid program. our average is in the 50s, but for some providers, we're in, you know, the 40% kind of category. So we are not a terrific provider, which has a real problem. So we had to do something about our Medi-Cal rates. Number one, because we need to sustain those safety net institutions that are seeing our low income population. And so, what are community clinics? I mean, how are they going to keep their door open without continuing the bake sales that they're having on the side? And our safety net institutions, the hospitals that essentially that folks are going to. So we needed to do a pretty hefty Medi-Cal rate increase to sort of kind of prop up our current safety net providers. But secondly, we have a terrible access problem. Nobody will take any new Medi-Cal patients. And so we're going to do this big expansion of Medi-Cal and essentially not have a place for them to go. So we also needed to be able to get more providers to be in the program. And so there, you're just not going to be able to have any discussion in California about expanding that program and expanding real access, quite honestly, without Medicaid rate increase.
Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, the follow-up would be that there's a certain part of the population that believes that because people are undocumented, they deserve no help from government or taxpayers, that sort of thing. What do you tell them, knowing what your answer was before?
You tell them that infectious diseases know no borders, and HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and other infectious diseases that are in the population of our restaurant workers, our hotel workers, our gardeners, and everybody else that is the underground economy of this country are undocumented. So people that are in our communities need to be healthy, whoever that is.
Does she have a question down here? Yes. You want to identify yourself?
My name is Jocelyn Frank. I'm a freelance journalist, and I also work for National Public Radio. I see that the study obviously focused on the rate of diabetes within the Latino and the community of, that identifies as Latino origins. And I'm wondering if you can tell me if the rate of diabetes within that community is actually on the rise when you account, obviously, for the population. It's growing very, very quickly. But is that actual rate of diabetes within the community also increasing disproportionately?
I'll let Bill answer part of that. Let me just state that this was a cross-sectional study, a one-time prevalence rate. So we're not talking about incidence, which is what you're asking about. We know that, for example, 10% of Latinos are diabetic. That's higher than the general population, which is at 6%. I'll let Bill see if he has any other data on that.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, clearly the U.S.-born population has a higher prevalence of diabetes. And with the longer you stay in the country, if you are an immigrant, the more likely you are to become obese, and then you'll become diabetic prone, and then a higher likelihood of prevalence there as well. So it unfolds over time. And this develops a curious irony that, you know, the more immigrants you have in the the population. It actually artificially lowers the prevalence of diabetes in the population. And is that, if you close that window and you have fewer of them and then you have more and more people staying for longer periods of time in residence as immigrants or their children, then the rates will eventually start climbing. They've already been climbing, but I mean they're going to just continue to move up.
We have time. Yeah, back there. We have time for your question and your question, and then we'll have to wrap it up.
Okay, my name is Joshua Massett. I'm a student of journalism at UCDC. My question is primarily for Elena Rio. I'd like to ask about the new media connections that you're hoping to make to be able to spread this information. You talked about using the internet and about using cable. I was wondering to what degree you want that collaboration, you want to what degree it's going to be and how you're hoping to, what you're hoping to achieve by it exactly.
Well, the National Hispanic Medical Association is working with CDC right now on developing health communications projects. And there are several national Hispanic-focused media right now that are interested, including Univision, which is cable and radio and TV, New America Media, and the Hispanic Publications of America. We've talked to them about being on an advisory committee, and we've also talked to new cable TV that are in the realm of public TV, Hispanic Telecommunications Network out of New York, for example. And there's lots of cable TV, and they are cable TV with satellite leasing that they do around the country and in Latin America. There's lots of opportunity right now to think about communications to the community from a health perspective, and we call it health communications. And we're very much interested as physicians who take a real interest in being leaders for our community and also being responsive to our communities, understanding the Latino culture and how Latino physicians and our other networks, we work with the Hispanic nurses and Hispanic dentists and Hispanic health executives and the Latino Caucus of APHA, and there's lots of interest in our professional communities to give back through this type of activity in being leaders involved in educating through media.
Go ahead. There's your microphone.
Emily from MedPage Today. This question is also for you. You mentioned some problems with legislation that's been introduced over the past 6 or 7 years. Could you just briefly talk what you think legislation is going to need to include if it has any chance of getting passed, and also maybe touch on if you think either of the two major presidential candidates have adequately addressed health disparities in their health care plans?
Yeah, the legislation I talked about is known as health disparities bills. This Congress's bills were called the Health Equity and Accountability Act. That was H.R. 3014 introduced by the Tri-Caucus of the United States Congress. Congresswoman Hilda Solis is the lead this year as the head of the Hispanic Healthcare Task Force, Congressional Hispanic Caucus Healthcare Task Force. And on the Senate side, the bill is Minority Health and Health Disparities Improvement Act, introduced by Senator Kennedy and Senator Cochran. What's important to realize is that the bills have been introduced in three Congresses and have been improving in terms of passage. As far as we know, the importance of a bill, the bill needs to be passed because there's bipartisan support and there's a lot more sponsors, let's say. And for both indicators, these bills have increased their bipartisan support and the number of sponsors. I think part of the problem has been the need for the leadership within the Senate to take it up as an important issue. The war and other things come up and keep coming up. And within the realm of health care, it was the Medicare Drug Act, and then it was SCHIP. And, you know, so the importance of health disparities and prevention, which these bills really focus on, needs to be looked at. And I think that because they're big bills, that perhaps taking them apart and putting them within other bills
where they can ride the success of, let's say, the if they had been part of the S-CHIP reauthorization or, you know, these other big programs that have to be reauthorized. I think that that would be the way to go. And also with healthcare reform could include health disparities, angles, and issues such as diabetes and obesity and prevention that's been mentioned here. Both campaigns have looked at underserved populations, but certainly the McCain agenda, which is more of, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and go out and have an ability to go to the market, is a little less friendly towards the low-income Latino population working at businesses that can't afford health insurance. So the Obama platform does have specific health disparities initiatives within its health agenda, especially prevention, obesity, diabetes, healthcare workforce, and lots of enrollment, cultural competence, language services, lots of things in Obama's platform.
Okay. Just about out of time. Deborah, you have any final words you'd like to share as we wrap it up?
I would invite everyone to go to our website at rwjf.org. We have a number of programs addressing all of the conditions that you heard spoken about today, diabetes, obesity, and coverage. We're very interested in hearing back from you about how you will use the information that we partner with Pew to collect. You can access the report on the website and on the Pew Hispanic Center.
Terrific. Thanks to the Alliance staff. I want to thank the Foundation for its participation in and help with and support of this briefing. Thank you for coming, and ask you to join me in thanking our panelists for an excellent presentation.